On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Mention public education in the United States, and the word reform is soon to follow. The need to reform the nation's schools is almost as old as public education itself. Invariably, the debate about how to improve public schools focuses on what's wrong with them. But across the country, there are examples of schools that work, classrooms abuzz with creativity and the excitement of learning. They're run by committed teachers, overseen by innovative principals, and supported by involved parents. In short, they're the nation's best schools that have mastered the art of teaching. But can they teach the rest of the country how to do what they do? Up next on Point, what makes a public school great? And joining me now on the line from Washington, D.C. is Jay Matthews. He's a contributing editor to Newsweek magazine, and he devised the magazine's system for ranking American high schools. He's also the education reporter for the Washington Post. And Jay Matthews, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, Anthony.
I appreciate having you on. Tell us, first of all, how Newsweek determines the best 100 high schools in the country. What's the formula that you use?
We divide the number of college-level tests taken in a school in May, and that's usually either advanced placement or international baccalaureate tests. We count up every test and divide by the number of graduating seniors. This was something I've been thinking about for 20 years and came up with this formula 10 years ago because I was seeing this gross inconsistency and almost dysfunction in the way we rated high schools. Hmm. Most Americans, even today, and I think you've covered schools, so you know this, rate schools this way. If the school's got a lot of rich kids, that's a good school. Hmm. If it's got a lot of poor kids, that's a bad school. But I spent the 80s hanging around a school in East Los Angeles full of low-income Mexican-American kids, Garfield High School, where 85% of the kids were low-income. Few of the parents had gotten beyond the sixth grade, but that was a great school. It had more kids taking AP Calculus than all but four high schools in the entire country. They had proved that if you gave low-income kids enough time and encouragement, they could learn at the very highest level and do very well. And then I moved to Scarsdale, New York, where my kid was going to a school that had the opposite philosophy. Scarsdale High School, unlike Garfield, didn't let anybody into AP want to take it. They didn't realize that AP was a great way to energize a kid, to challenge a kid, to get a kid ready for college. They said, no, only our A students can take our AP classes. They made my kid take an entrance test before he could even get into AP U.S. History. So I felt we should start measuring schools not by the way we do, which is how rich the parents are, but how hard the school is trying to get kids ready for college, and that's why Newsweek has come up with this rating system.
And does it rate how they do or just how many of them take these tests?
No, we don't look at the scores because that was one of the big problems with the way AP has been used. Most schools restrict access to AP. They only let their A students take it. So when you look at the percentage of passing scores in those schools, looks great, 85-90% kids passing, but only about 10-20 kids are taking the test. They're denying the B and C students a chance to get that taste of college trauma that will prepare them for college, because most of our B and C students in America go to college. 67% of our kids graduating from high school go to college. So I didn't want those schools to look good because they were doing the bad thing. So I decided the thing to do was just to measure participation. How many kids took the test? Because we've known, and I've been looking at this for a long time, that a kid, even a kid who struggles in an AP or an IB class and doesn't do well on the test, if he's working hard at it, he's going to have that taste of college trauma. He's going to be much better prepared for college than if he had been denied a chance to take these college-level courses, which is the way most high schools work.
Jay, let's talk a little bit about this list. What does the list tell us? Are there any themes that run through all of these 100 schools or most of these schools?
Well, there are two things that are surprising and were surprising to me that when I came up with the first list and still surprise many people. The first thing is, if you ranked schools any other way, one popular way of ranking schools is by average SAT scores. So if I had the top 100 schools by average SAT scores, there would not be a single school on that list that had as many as 30% low-income students. SAT scores are closely correlated, as you know, Anthony, to parental income. There would be no schools with a significant number of low-income students on that list. On our list, there are the top 100 schools on our list, there are 29 schools that have at least 30% free and reduced lunch kids and low-income kids, and some have over 50% low-income kids. So this makes me happy because it's a measurement of not how good the kids are, how what their backgrounds are, but how hard the school is trying to make kids better. The second surprising thing, which is that was the good news surprise, the bad news surprise was only 5% of all American high schools reach our modest standard of having at least one AP test per graduating senior. The vast majority of our high schools restrict access to AP, and thus they do not appear on this list, and it shows the problem we have.
But tell me if there are any ideas that sort of run through these schools. I mean, that is, you know, are they schools that are testing a lot, that insist on small class size? I mean, are there some formulas that other schools could look at these 100 schools and say, well, this works?
Well, you can look, for instance, at the top three, the Talented and Gifted Magnet in Dallas, Jefferson County IB School in Irondale, the Basis Charter in Tucson. Those are 1, 2, and 3 on the list. Those are schools of a very particular type. They're the new model for high schools. They're small. Probably only graduate, you know, less than 100 kids per class. They are focused. They have a top-flight principal who picks his or her own teachers who all are focused on the same goal to get kids, and in these cases, many of them low-income kids, up to a new standard of achievement. So at Gifted and Talented, Talented and Gifted in TAG, they call it, in Dallas, which is 40% Hispanic, 20% African-American, those kids take their first AP test when they're freshmen, and they take two more when they're sophomores, and then their junior and senior years, they're taking 6 AP tests each of those years. That's an extraordinary ramp up of academic standards for an American school. So when you have a small school with an active focused principal and active focused teachers, everybody is going in the same direction. It's exciting to come to school in the morning because you know what your goals are. Everybody's on the same page. I think that is probably... that is certainly my model for how to make schools better, and the top three schools on our list seem to show that that works for them.
Well, we're going to be talking to the principal of that school that you just mentioned in Dallas, Texas, later in the hour. But first, let me introduce Robert Schwartz. He's professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education in Cambridge, co-director of the Education Policy and Management Program, and he's been both a high school English teacher and a principal, and he joins me here in the studio. And Bob, thanks for coming in. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And J. Matthew Standby, you and Bob are going to be with us for the rest of the hour, but let me throw a question to you, Bob. What do you make of these of the Newsweek list? Is this a useful way to sort of begin to try to understand what works and what doesn't?
No, not particularly from my perspective. I'm a big fan of J. Matthews, but I'm not a big fan of lists generally. And
why not?
Well, the two things you most want to know about any educational institution are, first, what's the evidence that the school is actually adding value to what the kids brought to the school? And second, you want to know what actually happens to kids after they leave, after they exit the school. How well prepared are they for their next step? And I don't think, I mean, and these are very hard things to measure. And there is the natural tendency to glom onto more easily available indicators. And I certainly understand what Jay and Newsweek are trying to do here, which is to encourage more and more schools to provide access to a more challenging curriculum. And I think I have a lot of respect for the advanced placement program. And opening access to that, I think, is in itself a good thing. But I wouldn't confuse that with a serious effort to really measure how good a school is. I have to comment on Jay's point about, you know, the more traditional way of looking at schools, simply looking at the kind of socioeconomic composition of the student body. When you look at this list, one of the things that strikes me is that only 2 schools out of the first 100 are schools that are serving predominantly, and by that I mean roughly 2/3 of the kids being low income. Our biggest problems in American education tend to be concentrated in those schools, mostly inner city schools, serving high proportions of low income and minority kids. And when you even go to the all 500 schools listed, only 11 or 12 of those schools are schools that are heavily focused on serving low-income and minority kids. And again, we can come back and talk
sure.
about this.
Yeah, Jay, but we're going to have to go to a break in about 20 seconds, but let me just give you a quick opportunity to respond to that. I mean, I guess the question that I had when I looked at the list is, you know, I see schools from suburbs like McLean, Virginia, and Bethesda and other places. I mean, are there lessons on this list that can actually help some of the inner city schools where the challenges are the biggest that Bob Schwartz is talking
about? I mean, Bob obviously wants more kids on the list, so do I. But we are identifying far more schools that are working in the inner city than any other means of looking at schools has ever done. And we're identifying something that those schools can actually succeed at. You know, the number of schools that are at 50% free and reduced, which is way above the average, is much higher than just two on this list. So I think you have to sort of look at each school to see how this is working.
Okay. At the beginning of the Newsweek piece, it says that there's a radical idea transforming thousands of high schools across the country, and that is a one-size-fits-all approach no longer works for everyone. A more individualized experience is better. Can you sort of expand on that? What are we talking about? And you know, offer some examples of that, because that seems to be the thrust of this survey by Newsweek.
We're learning now that our problem in American education is we've ignored kids in the middle. We focused our use of AP and IB as an example of that. We focused simply on the top students, giving them our best courses, and let everybody else sort of slide through with whatever we had. The dregs of courses. I mean, the difference between Bob and Bob is a great educator and a great mathematician, and great educators hate ranked lists. Journalists like them because they're accessible to readers and they help readers understand issues. But I think both of us will agree that our schools have been ignoring the kids in the middle, and often the kids in the middle have difficulty learning because they have different learning styles. The focus now is to create schools that engage every kid, and we're finding with smaller high schools that you can do that better. Make sure that in every lesson the teacher is making sure every kid is participating, that the teacher develops a personal relationship with every kid, and you have enough time by lengthening the school day in many of these cases to try different learning styles, different ways of approaching the subject matter, combine both traditional teaching and projects, and that way you can bring every kid up to the level we want them to be.
Hmm. Bob Schwartz, your distaste for lists notwithstanding, does that make sense? I mean, making an effort to focus on this group of kids in the middle?
Yeah, I'm really glad Jay said that, because I do think that the power of this notion of trying to provide more access to advanced level courses is a good strategy for dealing with the kids in the middle. My earlier comment was focused on the fact that the more serious problem, in my view, is the problem of the bottom quartile, if you will. Mm. The kids who either drop out almost from the time they arrive in high school, or who manage to stay through high school, but don't complete high school with a strong enough set of skills to be able to take a meaningful next step. So yes, as a strategy for reaching the middle, this does make sense. I would also say, by the way, that in terms of kind of bottom quartile kids, if you want to put it in those terms, the same principles here that Jay was just describing around smaller schools, more theme-based schools, more opportunities for kids to do project-based work, more opportunities for kids to mix learning in classrooms with learning out in the community, these strategies really do seem to be taking hold.
Hmm.
I should mention, in terms of Jay's interest about college-level work, there are at least two other strategies which I don't think Jay's ranking system picks up very well. One of them is a phenomenon that is mentioned in the narrative in the Newsweek article, and that is this new phenomenon of what we're calling early college high schools. That is, high schools that actually in some cases begin really in grade 7 or 8 that are heavily focused on low-income and minority kids and kids who have not been performing very well, and that aim over a 4 or 5 year period to enable those kids to leave high school with at least 1 year and ideally 2 years' worth of college credit.
Now, what's the advantage of that?
Well, the advantage of that is they're twofold. One, for low-income kids in particular, there's a powerful financial incentive to get be accumulating college credits while you're in high school. But the second and even more important advantage is that most low-income kids going off to college are going out into pretty large, typically public institutions that typically don't pay a lot of attention to freshmen. Kids are thrown into large classes. There's not individualized attention and support. And if you can get kids across that bridge into post-secondary education in a more supportive, controlled environment. And by the way, a lot of these high schools are actually located on college campuses, so kids have the opportunity to get the experience of being in a college setting, but also have the support system, if you will, of high school adults who know them well and can work pretty closely with them. There are about 170 of these schools now, either open or on the books. This has been one of several major investments that the Gates Foundation has made, and this is important. The other point I wanted to make, and I'd be curious to get Jay's comment on this, is that alongside AP, there's almost as many kids in this country participating in what are called dual enrollment programs. That is, they are in high school, but they are taking courses for college credit. Some of those courses are delivered on a college campus. Some of those college courses are delivered in high schools. And am I right, Jay, that this ranking system doesn't pick up that phenomenon?
Yeah, we've tried to. The problem is it's very hard to gauge the rigor of the tests at the end of those programs. As you've talked to college admissions counselors who have seen some dual enrollment programs that really aren't very strong, and we tried to figure out a way to measure the strong ones and not the weak ones, and it's very difficult to do that.
And I gather that this kind of approach, one of the big issues in public education that I know that you two are obviously very familiar with, and that is kids getting out of high school aren't necessarily prepared for college work. This is obviously going to address that issue in a big way.
I mean, the great study, we've had two studies, huge studies in Texas and California recently, that show that a kid who passed an AP exam in high school has a significantly better chance of graduating from college. Mm.
One more voice I want to bring into the show, and this is Michael Saturino. He's the principal at the Talented and Gifted Magnet High School in Dallas, Texas, and that was the number one ranked school in this survey by Newsweek magazine. And Jay Matthews, you were referring to this school a moment ago. And Principal Saturino, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's an honor that you would consider me worthy to be on the show.
Oh, well, it's our honor to have you. You've been listening to this conversation. I'd love to just throw a very general question out to you. I mean, what's the secret down there in Dallas, Texas, and at your school? What's going on there that makes that school so good and worthy of being on the top of this 100 list of great schools?
Well, the key to any success, I was told by my first superintendent that I worked for 22 years ago, is an effective and successful school is very easy to define, very hard to achieve. You have a triangle, and the vertices of that triangle are student, parent, and teacher. Mm. And if that triangle is equilateral, you are going to have a successful and effective school. The way you can achieve that most efficiently is a low student-teacher ratio, which unfortunately, in these difficult financial times, you have to have a general superintendent and a board of trustees that is willing to assume that cost and allow you to continue that. And one of the greatest advantages that our students have is that we have a low student-teacher ratio, which allows for the family atmosphere, getting them to know us and us to know them. And they learn to trust us, and it brings about a family environment, and it works very well for us.
How low is that student-teacher ratio at your school?
We have 197 students, and we have 15 teachers. Comes to somewhere around 1 to 13, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Jay Matthews, you know, when I have covered this issue over the years, and I wanted to sort of throw this out to actually all three of you, and I have a feeling that the Principal Saturino is being a little modest here. I mean, it seems to me that when you talk about what is the consistent thing that runs through great schools, it's great people, it's great administrators, more than these other themes. How important is that, Jay?
You know, I think the quality of the principal is number one. My favorite model, school model at the moment, is the KIPP schools, the Knowledge is Power program, which are growing throughout. These are middle schools in inner cities. They've had phenomenal results by putting all the focus on picking the best, brightest young people that they could find to be the principal, letting them hire and fire their teachers, letting them decide how they're going to teach kids, mm-hmm. simply saying to them, do whatever you can that works, just help these kids raise the level. Mike Saturino is genius, and he's not only a genius, but he's had 10 years at that school to build up the kind of results that he's had by creating that family atmosphere. He goes out and recruits kids in the inner city Dallas looking for kids who's from families that really don't expect this kind of treatment, and the results are obvious.
Well, that's Principal Saturino. Do you want to comment on that? I mean, do you feel that the kind of freedom and flexibility that you have as a principal is key to your success there?
Yes, sir. You have to, if you are any kind of an administrator, the first thing you have to do is know yourself. You have to know what your good points are. You have to know what your bad points are. And you need to find people and hire them who can cover up your bad points and enhance your good points. And what I'm saying is that I've been able to find people, very quality human beings in the educational profession, who are willing to come and work here, work with me, and they do cover my faults and enhance my talents, and so I get an opportunity to talk with you.
Well, I would say that among your faults is perhaps modesty is what I was going to maybe. Yeah, go ahead, Bob Schwartz.
Just a quick comment, and that is that this is by no means at all to diminish the accomplishments of what is obviously a terrific school. The big challenge in particularly urban education is to do this at scale. Almost any urban district that I could take you to, we could find handfuls of really good schools. And the question, you know, back to the principal, is to what degree do the rules that you operate under, are those the same rules that other principals have in the district? And what's your sense of what it would take to create many more schools like yours, just even within your own large district?
Great, great question. Principal Saturino.
Excuse me. Well, the biggest thing, again, that I'll come back to is that you have to have a general superintendent and a board of trustees who are willing to make the financial bite that allows you to go out and hire these people that are out there that are very quality educators. You have to be able to give them an environment in which they feel supported, and you have to give them an environment in which they think they can be successful. And the best way to do that is to give them an environment where they have a small student-teacher ratio. And again, that requires the maximum commitment of dollars because it increases the per-student cost. And throughout the state here in Texas, per-student cost for our school is somewhere around $6,100 in the state of Texas. Compared to a little above $5,000 for your comprehensive high schools. And, I really feel that TAG strategies, talented and gifted strategies, should be used in all schools because they are successful. And the best TAG strategy that we have is the small student-teacher ratio. You give a teacher that's got some talent an opportunity to work individually, one-on-one with students every day, to get together with other teachers and work with interdisciplinary seminars, those kids, whether they're talented and gifted or not, are going to improve dramatically because they see the opportunity that, okay, I can do this because I'm not anonymous. They know me, they know about me, and I care about me, and I'm going to do the best I can.
Okay, Michael Saturino, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Thanks to Jay Matthews, and good luck to everybody in the educational business. I pray for all of you every day.
All right. Good luck to you, sir. Thanks very much. That was Michael Saturino. He's the principal at the Talented and Gifted Magnet High School in Dallas, Texas. And let's take some calls, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, one thing is I really liked what the principal said, but I would discourage you from calling him a genius because you're emphasizing that maybe, you know, if there's only a few people like him, then only a few schools are going to be able to achieve what he's achieved, and that's just not true. It can be achieved in a lot of different places. I told your screener 30 minutes ago, and the principal just mentioned it for the first time in the show. Two things will I've taught in the public schools as a substitute teacher, and there's two things which will help schools. One is lower class size, what I told the screener 30 minutes ago. And
thank you for your patience,
parental,
Paul.
And parental involvement. No, I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying that 30 minutes into the show, Michael said you had to have parental involvement, and he said class size being small. That's it. Those are the two things. It's just like weight loss. You can put lip gloss on. You can take a new diet. You got to eat less, and exercise more. In schools, it's smaller class size, That'll allow the teachers to shine. It'll allow the principals to shine, and most of all, it'll allow the kids to shine. But even mediocre teachers will be good teachers in a small classroom size with parental support.
Well, smaller class size is a direct result of funding. What's the trick, Paul, from your perspective as a teacher, to get parents involved?
Well, you know, you can do that if you take away some of the administrative bull that goes on top of the teachers now. And if you reduce the class size, they do have the time to devote to a kid, like the principal said, to know the kid. And then they'll have time for after-school conferences with the parents and be able to encourage the kids that way through their parents and get their parents involved. And that's going to do it. That's the only way. There is no way to legislate parental involvement. Mm-hmm. That is the only way, is to get the teachers to be, you know, charismatic in the sense that they are right there with the kids, they're part of the kids' lives, and they're not just floating through the kids' lives and vice versa. The kids are floating through their schoolroom.
Okay. Paul, listen, thanks for the call. You put some good stuff on the table. Jay Matthews, what do you hear from this former teacher in terms of, I mean, he says it all comes down to class size and parental involvement.
Well, he makes some good points. First, I think that we have more than enough genius principals out there to serve every school we've got. The quality of our educators are terrific. The problem is we don't put them in situations where they can really affect that. I think that in order to create the great schools in the communities that Bob and I are most concerned about, inner city, the only way to get good parental involvement is to produce a good school. I think you have to start with a school that's functioning, where kids are learning. At that point, the parents who are jaded and discouraged and just don't believe that educators can do it right anymore will turn around and become involved in that school. But you have to show them what you got first before you can get them involved. Class size, I'm on the fence about that. The studies show that class size really only works if you can get class size below 18 kids per class. That's very difficult to do, and I've seen lots of very successful models, including the KIPP schools. They're doing a wonderful job with class sizes. They're getting up to 27, 28. Their focus is on good principals who can hire and fire great teachers, a program that's focused on the right direction. I think you can do pretty well with bigger class sizes than he says.
And on the line now is Spencer Kern. He's an 18-year-old senior at the Martin Luther King High School, a magnet school in Nashville, Tennessee. The school was ranked number 39 out of the top 100 public schools by Newsweek. And Spencer, thanks for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
I really appreciate it. So, you know, we wanted to call you because we were worried that we wouldn't get calls from students, but we'd really like to know from a student's perspective what makes the Martin Luther King High School so good in your view.
From my perspective, the things that really make it good are, you know, I've heard you've been talking about different class sizes. But, you know, if the students in the class are really interested in learning and, you know, are interested in listening to the teacher and engaging in the classroom, then it almost doesn't matter what size the class is. You know, even if it's up around 30, then you can still have a really good school where all the students learn things.
And so what's going on there at Martin Luther King High School that, I mean, I assume you're suggesting that the kids are engaged and they're happy to be in the classroom and they're learning. I mean, what's going on there that works so well?
I think it's just kind of the general attitude of the school. You know, if the school is, the students there come with the expectation to learn, and they're going there for some reason other than, you know, their parents, so then they come and they're prepared and they're more willing to, you know, engage in the classroom. And which is one of the advantages of the magnet school, is that because of the fact of the academic entry requirements, students who don't really want to learn don't apply.
Yeah. Bob Schwartz, what do you hear in Spencer Kern's comments about his school?
I was just going to ask him whether or not there were, in fact, entrance requirements. And I'm assuming, Spencer, that your point is that students and families make an explicit choice for this kind of school, and that's half the battle, in a sense, is people being motivated to want this particular kind of education?
Yes. I mean, you were talking about, once again, parent involvement. The parents and the students have to make the decision to, go for a better education. And so if they, you know, even they go to either, they move somewhere where they've got a better public school, or they go to an academic magnet school where they take the best courses that are given by the student's public school. And, you know, just them sitting down and making, you know, a decision to, strive towards academic, excellence, will just improve the school as a whole, as well as making a better learning environment for everyone.
Spencer, are you looking forward to going on to college next year?
Yes, I am. I'm really looking forward to
it. Where are you going?
Right now, I think I'm going to Kalamazoo College in Michigan.
All right.
Small liberal arts colleges.
Well, congratulations, and thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Spencer. That was Spencer Kern. He's a senior at Martin Luther King High School, a magnet school in Nashville, Tennessee. Let's take a couple of calls. John is calling from Davenport, Iowa. Hi, John.
Hello. I'd like to make 4 points.
Four. Why don't you make the top 2 points, because our time is tight.
Top two are this.
Yeah.
You need to turn over some of the choice of the learning to the students. I taught for 14 years in public schools. Mostly 8th and 9th grade. And when I taught 8th grade, it was very labor-intensive for me as a teacher because I had a large class for each of my classes. But I gave them a list of 40 topics, 40 items that they could do projects of, and 2 days a week they'd work on the one that they chose, and they outlined to me how they were going to do it. So they learned planning skills, and then they would do it. There were things like cartoon strips, where they would learn, when they did it, how to sequence ideas, how to format, and also I could check their grammar and do things a little at a time. They did interviewing skills with people in the neighborhood, and we had an interview form that they would work on with me.
So, John, I want to put your ideas on the table. It sounds like you're talking about empowering the students to have a say in what they study.
That's very true. It doesn't matter if the class is large or small. If it's large, it's just more labor intensive for the teacher. And I'll tell you, I had almost no personal life during those years because my life was my students.
Well, it sounds like you're the kind of teacher that more students need. Thanks for the call. Bob Schwartz, when you hear John talking about allowing students to sort of have a say in what they're studying, is that an approach that has traction?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, as coming back to Spencer's comment, the key here is finding ways to really engage students and have them take more ownership and responsibility for their own learning, and good teachers seek out ways to do that, even in the most conventional kinds of schools.
Let's go to Phil, who's calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Thanks very much. I read the Newsweek article, quite a change from last year's top 100. In fact, couldn't recognize any of most of the schools. I thought a public school actually dealt with the catchment area, that automatic enrollment, not pre-selection, not invitation, not payment. So therefore, this is a bit of a bogus list.
Now, wait, Phil, why are you saying that? Because you think these are selective schools?
Well, they certainly are. I mean, the top school is selective. The principal goes around and looks for students, and quite apart from the fact that it only has 197 students, what kind of high school is that? When my daughter goes to Newton North, it has 1,300 high school or students.
All right, well, listen, you raise a point.
Just one point about the AP courses. You know, students play a little game with AP courses. They figure if they take an AP course and get a C, that's equal to a B+ in the honors courses. And colleges are much more impressed with AP, no matter what mark you get. So, therefore, I think you have to give some consideration to the fact that some of these AP courses are the system is abused, and to include that the AP course as the main criteria for the so-called top 100 so-called public schools is actually quite misleading.
Well, you've put two things on the table, Phil, and I want to put them to Jay Matthews. Jay, you know, speak to Phil's issue about this list not representing the vast population of American high school kids.
There are 1,139 schools on this list, fewer than 100 of them are the kind of selective schools that Phil's talking about. The vast majority of these schools are schools like Newton North, who are smart enough to open up their AP and IB courses to all students to make the ticket into the course just the desire to take it. And it's very difficult to abuse an AP course. The secret of the AP course is that the final exam is written and graded by outside experts who have nothing to do with the school. In most classes in high school, the teacher writes and grades the exam, and it's constantly the kids trying to game the teacher back and forth. Can you make it a little easier, Mrs. Jones? When you have a test that you cannot game, that creates a team spirit, the teacher and the kids together trying to beat that test. It's a much more better educational environment, and it works for lots of schools.
Jay, Phil, thanks for the call. You know, Jay and Bob, I'm just struck because something that I just thought would be sacred to everyone was this idea that small classes, you know, are a must for good education. We've heard former teachers calling, saying that not necessarily. I mean, it's more important, the content in the classroom, than the numbers of kids in the seats. Another thing that I wanted to raise as if this can be challenged, and let me put this to you, Bob Schwartz, and that is this idea that, which seems sort of intuitive, and I think a lot of people believe this, that high schools should be focused on one thing and one thing only, and that is preparing kids to go to college. Is that a good way to think about that?
I'm glad you raised that. One of the most stubborn statistics in this whole enterprise is the proportion of 25 to 29-year-olds who actually wind up with a baccalaureate degree. And people argue back and forth about these statistics, but if you start by looking at a cohort of eighth-grade kids and ask how many of them, you know, by the time they're in their mid to late 20s, have actually gotten a college degree, the most sort of generous interpretation is about a third. And that typically it's about 28% of the cohort with a baccalaureate degree and then another 8% or so with an associate's degree. We have a whole secondary school system set up on the premise that college going preparing kids for college and enabling them to complete college is the point of the enterprise. One of the things that really distinguishes us from virtually all other industrialized countries is other countries don't see college going as the sole end of high school. They create systems to really enable large numbers of kids to make a smooth transition from school to work. We basically don't have that. Now, the reason, if Jay's strategy is successful, more kids taking more rigorous courses, getting better prepared for college, we will certainly cut into the college dropout rate, which is enormous. But we still will have, even if this strategy is totally successful, I would argue half the kids, if you start with an eighth grade cohort, are still basically not getting the kind of options and opportunities that they need. Incentives to really stay in high school and support in moving on to a next step. So that's one of the things that troubles me about saying that the best American high schools are solely defined by college preparation.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Catherine is calling from Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in the role of the teachers' unions in those top 1,000 schools. I come from a state that has an extremely strong teachers union, Rhode Island, and I worked in the school system for 4 years. And I have to admit, it's hard for me to admit, being a woman who is pro-labor, that the teachers union has really allowed for teachers who really aren't quality teachers to stay in their situations. And the principal does not have the power to do much about it.
Okay, that's a great question, Catherine. Jay Matthews, can you speak to that issue with regard to this top 100 list? What in general, what's the relationship with the teacher unions in these great schools?
Well, there isn't a clear one. The three or four states that do the best on the list are Florida, Texas, California. Texas and Florida are weak union states. California is a strong union state. But I find that unions are getting smarter about this. They don't really get in the way of getting programs that get more kids into top classes. They do get in the way, however, of smaller schools of the sort we're talking about that let the principal hire and fire their teachers, and that's a real problem. You need a principal to have that power, otherwise you're not going to be building up the concerted, unified focus that a good school needs.
Bob, it seems like no conversation about how to improve public schools can avoid stumbling on this issue of unions, whether they're too inflexible, whether they need to be more flexible.
Yeah, I actually think there's a fair amount of movement in the biggest cities on that. If you look at the recent teacher union contracts in New York and Chicago and Philadelphia, for example, you now see significantly more flexibility of the sort that Jay is calling for, more decision-making at the school level around selection of teachers. The example that Jay alluded to a while ago of these KIPP schools, which I'm a big fan of as well, these are basically charter schools that operate with a separate set of rules, and they And a lot of the, I suspect, Jay, that a lot of the smaller, more theme-based schools on your list are also schools that have managed to negotiate the kind of flexibility for selection of staff that, that charters typically have.
I wanted to ask you both, and let me start with you, Jay, just to give a sort of sampling. In the Newsweek piece, you talk about, I think the term is theme-based schools. That is, these are schools, some schools are focused on preparing for work. There's one school in Washington, D.C. that's preparing kids for civics, essentially. There's different schools that are preparing kids for science and math and technology. What's the advantage of these schools? And are they sort of part of a movement that we're beginning to see?
They are. They do what you need to do with any kind of lively high school. You get give kids a reason to get up in the morning and want to get to school. If you have a theme and it's attractive to the kid, the school in D.C. Makes the puts the kids in the Supreme Court, in Congress, learning from government officials. That's new. That's exciting. Anything that sort of unifies a school gets the teachers, the principal, the kids, the parents all moving in the same direction. Unlike our usual inner city schools where everybody is in a different place, that school is going to do much better.
Can I comment
on
that?
Yeah, please, Bob.
The earlier caller, Jay, who was complaining about the difference in the list from this year to last year, part of that strikes me as, I mean, this difference is picking up on the fact that in the last two or three years, we have seen a pretty significant explosion of these more smaller, more theme-based schools. A lot of it with a lot encouragement and financial support in big city districts from the Gates Foundation and Carnegie and others. But I think this is part of a pretty significant set of changes that are underway. A common element here in a lot of the callers that we've heard from is the importance of choice and student engagement. And obviously, these theme-based schools are a strategy for getting at that.
I mean, just to play devil's advocate here, are we not sort of sacrificing this kind of sacred idea? Maybe it's not sacred, but this idea of public education where there's this shared experience, whether you're raised in Pennsylvania or California. I mean, isn't this one of the things that holds us together as a nation?
That's a myth. We now have big high schools full of kids and cliques. Some of the brightest kids get the attention, the others are overlooked. The idea of the shared experience is something we think we love, but it's a myth. It doesn't exist in our average public schools now.
You're nodding your head, Bob Schwartz.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it is a myth that we like to hold on to. I mean, I do worry at the extremes of creating a system in which kids have less and less opportunity to really mix with kids of different interests and backgrounds. But the reality is we have both economic stratification by neighborhood and social stratification within these big high schools.
Jay Matthews, let me put this final question to you, and that is, you've been covering education for quite a while. Are we on the right track? I mean, forgive me for not knowing exactly. Is it 20 years or so on this beat? 23 years. So, are we making progress? I know there's a lot of work to do, but as you look out there.
Bob and I are exactly in the same place.
Yeah.
I'm going to echo what he said at the beginning of this show. The top 70% of our kids are in pretty good schools that are getting better. We're learning all kinds of things about how to educate. And the rise of AP and IB in our high schools is a particularly strong and positive change. The bottom 25% of our kids are in bad schools that aren't doing the job, that have to be fixed, that have to be brought up, that have to be given an alternative for the better schools that will raise those kids higher.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave this show with that challenge on the table. I want to thank you both for joining us. Jay Matthews, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Jay Matthews, contributing editor to Newsweek. He's also the education reporter for The Washington Post. And here in the studio, Robert Schwartz, thank you for coming in very much.
My pleasure.
That's Bob Schwartz, professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. You can continue the conversation, download the On Point podcast, and subscribe to our daily newsletter at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.